Welcome to Private Club Radio, your weekly source for industry education, news and discussion. Broadcasting from Tampa, Florida, ladies and gentlemen, here is your host, Gabriel Aloisi.
Another month is in the books. Happy May 1st to you. Thanks for joining me once again here on Private Club Radio, where this week we have a fantastic guest joining us. His name is John McCabe. He's the former general manager of the Union League Club of Chicago. He was there for over 22 years, and he has a ton of experience in city clubs, which is what we'll be talking about with him today. Specifically, we're going to discuss the club of the future. So if you're wondering what the club is going to look like in the next 5 or 10 years, pay attention to this episode. So I was down at Golf Galaxy the other day. I went there just to hit some balls and kind of mess around. My buddy kept talking about this epic driver, this new driver from Callaway, and I just wanted to go check it out and give it a test drive, if you will. So I'm hitting a few balls, and the guy walks over to me, and I'm like, oh, God, the sales guy, here he comes. And he starts working with me, actually, and he's a really nice guy, and he says, you have a very weak grip. I don't think anyone has ever told that to me before. I've never even thought about my grip. I've had the same grip I've ever had since I was a kid, since my father first taught me how to play golf. And so he says, I want you to do something for me. Turn your grip a little to the inside. It's going to feel uncomfortable, but just make that really slight adjustment and let's see what happens. So I did. It did feel really, really weird, but I took a few shots with it. And I noticed the contact off the club felt a little bit more solid. So as with my old grip, I was hitting the ball about 225, 230, which is nothing to write home about. I changed that grip a little bit, and all of a sudden, I'm starting to hit the ball 250, 260, 275. My swing speed goes up 10 miles per hour. I'm hitting it straighter. My miss hits are going 230, whereas they were going 210 before. Sometimes even going 240, and my shot dispersion is a lot better. I'm not hooking the ball. I'm not slicing the ball. Even when I miss it, I'm only missing a little bit off of my target. So we could say that it was the epic driver, right? Like this shiny new $500 driver, which I did in fact buy. So I went over there to hit a few balls and one of those impulse buys, boom, there goes $500. And I just bought myself a new driver, right? Was it the epic driver? Maybe. But I like to think it was changing that one little thing with my grip. I made a little tiny tweak and it had profound impact on my swing. That's exactly the same thing that happens when it comes to clubs. You can make a small tweak to your service, to your amenities, to the way you communicate, and it can have profound impact. That's what we're going to talk about with John McCabe today. And that's exactly what I talk about during my keynote on millennials, how to market to millennials. It's not that a club has to change its entire communication strategy. It's that you can make a simple tweak and start to focus on things your club already has that can have profound effects on getting younger members into your club. I'm giving that talk to the CMAA up at the Great Lakes Regional Conference later this year in October. But you can also hear that same content in my online course, which you can find at privateclubradio.com/education. You don't have to piss off your existing members. Everything I teach you in that course is something that your club already has. You're probably just not putting a focus on it. But when you do, your club will be that much more attractive to the millennial generation. So it's privateclubradio.com/education. I hope you can check out that course that I have online for you. Today, my guest is Jonathan McCabe of Jonathan McCabe Consulting, a hospitality consulting company focused on private clubs. John was the general manager and chief operating officer of the Union League Club of Chicago for over 22 years. He retired back in 2014. That club was ranked the number one city club in America by the Club Managers Forum from 2009 to 2012. And it was recognized as a platinum club and distinguished emerald club. John was named Hotelier of the Year by the Illinois Hotel and Lodging Association, and he's written and published numerous articles for professional publications in our industry. He speaks at a lot of the conferences, and today he's going to be on chatting with us about the Club of the Future. John, welcome to Private Club Radio.
Gabe, thanks for having me. It's a real privilege.
Yeah, thank you so much. And so when we talk about the Club of the Future, we really should start from the beginning, I think. So let's talk about the history of private clubs and what's gotten us to where we are here and then where it's going.
Well, it depends on how far back you want to go. If we go back to clubs of old times, they started as trade unions and they were all groups of people who worked together. And I'm sure most people in our industry know that, but I like to go back to Lloyd's of London, which is, as we all know, the insurance company. And that started in Lloyd's Coffee House and still operates kind of on that same premise. So clubs were places where people who had the same ideas, same interests, same common background got together and enjoyed each other's company or did things together. And clubs of today are much the same. Most of the focus of when I talk about the Club of the Future has to do with city clubs as opposed to country clubs, but it's certainly applicable because country clubs are rapidly losing the next generation of people. Golf is way down. Millennials don't play golf like my generation did and yours also. So there are a lot of things that are going on that are changing that. So clubs that have retained their focus and have retained their vision of what they were and what they should be seem to be doing well. Clubs who have become desperate and trying to get members at any cost get exactly what they should, and that's not a whole hell of a lot of anything.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think the discounting and all that, it's going to catch up with you sooner than later for sure.
Amen.
Yep. So what are some of the other mitigating factors that have gotten us to where we are today here, John?
The changes in society. One of the things that is so striking is how differently we communicate. I mean, Gabe, you and I were talking before we got on the air about in the old days when I had an issue, I had to send a letter and make a phone call. And today we send emails. We speak like we are now on Skype. Yep. Things are very, very different. And so the rapidity of communication, there still is an enormous need, in fact, even a greater need for communal activity. Millennials and basically anyone under 40 studies and works differently than I do. I'm, 68 years old now, and so the world that I grew up in is very different. When I went to college, I got my assignment, went back to my dorm, pulled out my Smith Corona portable typewriter, and in the privacy of my own dorm room or in the library, I did my reports. Today, groups of young people get together, they go to the library, they spread out at a common table. Everybody brings their laptop and everything is done collaboratively. Mm-hmm. So there's a great need, even though they're very electronically oriented, there's an enormous socialization that occurs around their electronics that a lot of clubs are really absolutely completely missing. Soho House becomes kind of the poster child of what a club of the future is and can be, and we can go as deep into that as you want to.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's talk about the Soho House because you've brought that up to me a couple times now.
Right. Well, Soho House is kind of, so Soho House knows exactly what it is and what it wants to be. Soho House is all about people who are in the arts and in the entertainment business, and they actually have put a sign up in the lobby of the New York Soho House in 2010 that showed a man in a suit with a line through it saying "No suits allowed."
Nice.
It speaks to their membership. Sure. The one here in Chicago I've been to a number of times, and I went up. I was dressed one day in a pair of slacks and a sport coat and an open shirt, and I went up on their roof deck in the pool, and there were more tattoos on any one person at the pool than I had seen collectively in the past week.
There'd be a lot of blushing in a lot of other clubs around the country if you saw that.
Absolutely. It's completely different. I really urge managers to go to Soho House's website and take a look at it. They know who they are. They know what they're doing. They have their market nailed and they kill it. So let's go back to that sign in 2010. So Nick James owns Soho House. Sole proprietor, owned it all. He actually sold part of the company to another fellow, but he's running the program. The Soho House in New York had really flatlined in terms of growth and, in fact, had not met any of their expectations. He went to the club, saw people in suits. He had Wall Street guys. He had bankers. He had lawyers. He had all the wrong people for his market in the club. So what he did when that sign didn't work in December of 2010, he went through his roster and kicked out 1,000 members.
Wow.
These people pay $2,000 a year dues. I'm not the brightest guy in the world, but I understand that's $2 million net out of Nick's pocket.
Just in the dues, never mind everything else they're spending at the club.
Exactly. So he gave up $2 million in dues line just to purify the club.
Wow.
So what that did for him, though, is the club exploded again. He now has opened a second club in New York, and both are completely private. Soho House has this really cool model. Like here in Chicago, they haven't hit their cap yet. And so they leave it open to the great unwashed masses of society like me, who might actually want to wander in there. And there are two restaurants that I can eat in there. Now, I limited where else I can go in the club. And they're very strict about it. They are out clubbing traditional private clubs. I had a son of a friend of mine who was a member of the Union League Club. Young man was on the advisory board of the Art Institute. They've got a lot of artists who are members of Soho House. He could not get in. I had three other members at Soho House trying to get him in. I spoke to the GM, could not get this young man into the club because he was a suit.
Mm-hmm. And they got a no suit policy. That's how it works.
Well, but he worked in a suit world. He worked in that world, and he just didn't meet their model.
Sure.
So they're out clubbing traditional private clubs. You go to the Union League Club, the University Club, the Standard Club. They'll take, people of all walks of life. Mm-hmm. Dress codes are profoundly different between the clubs. And Soho House is nailing its niche.
So for clubs that aren't in the position where they can start to be turning people away, how do they get there? Is it just by owning those values, John? Or what other things are they going to need to do to start changing what they're doing now and preparing for that?
One of the worst words in the English language in a private club is, well, it's our tradition. Mm-hmm. Tradition is a byword for I'm not willing to change or look at anything different than what I am. It's a terrible word. And clubs have to reexamine who they're serving, who actually is in leadership, and is the leadership of the club in tune with the members, and more important, is the leadership in tune with the potential members. The clubs need to recognize what they are, what they do, who they are. University Club has a very clear message. You have to be a university graduate. Union League Club is all about philanthropy. They operate 9 or 10 boys and girls clubs in inner city. They serve 13,000 disadvantaged kids. They support the U.S. Army. They support the U.S. Navy. They have a civic and arts foundation that provides scholarships to young people in the visual arts. They have an engineering foundation. They're all about community. Their motto is commitment to community and country. There are a ton of people in Chicago who want to be involved in the community in kind of a clean hands way. Mm-hmm. Not everybody wants to go into the inner city of Chicago and teach at a Boys and Girls Club, but you can be part of it by being a member of the Union League Club. You can support it, and you can actually go when you want to. Mm-hmm. And so so they need to be true to what they're doing, and they also need to be really open to what's going on for the next generation.
How do you determine those values, John? How do you decide what we are? Do you just take a look at what the overarching principles of most of the members are, or how do you take a look at that?
I think most clubs were actually born with that. One of the clubs that's really the purest of that is the Cosmos Club in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful old line club founded in the 1880s. They are the birthplace of the National Geographic Society. In order to become a member of the Cosmos Club, you had to have a great life's achievement. Mm-hmm. When you go into the club, they have pictures of their members who are, Supreme Court justices, Nobel laureates, et cetera. Mm-hmm. When you go into their library, half the library is made up of books by members. And then they have books by members that won Pulitzer Prizes.
Wow.
Then you go into the next room and they have the plaques on the wall for all their members who received Nobel Prizes. Then you walk around the corner and they've got a wall, and on the wall are the postage stamp members who are on postage stamps on countries from all over the world.
Wow.
Now, in the 90s and 2000s, the club was having a hard time filling its membership. People weren't as involved, and like many city clubs, they widened their focus. Is that a good way of, it sounds better than saying lost their way. They widened their focus as all clubs did. Union League Club did, every, you know, most of the city clubs did. They're, you know, and they're the obvious city clubs that are killing it. Back in the, you know, 1988, I think the Club Managers Conference was in Orlando. And at that time, CCA had probably 200 rooftop city clubs on their way to 220 or so, I think was the magic number that they finally hit as the most. Mm-hmm. And to some of us, it was pretty obvious that city clubs like that were going to die pretty quickly, and they have. Mm-hmm. City clubs in general are dying. So there's a and country clubs are dying. So there's a real necessity to have the right number of clubs in a community. I think, you know, Philadelphia and Detroit really do that well. Mm-hmm. The DAC is prospering. We've got really great leadership with Ted Galeri. He got them through the, you know, the crushing times that occurred in downtown Detroit. You've got Jeff McFadden in Philadelphia with the only, at the Union League, the only real club downtown. There are a couple of others, but they really own the market. And a friend of mine said to me the other day, anybody who makes more than $250,000 a year and lives in Philadelphia has to be a member of the Union League. Uh-huh. But again, they have a purpose. They're all about the history. They were founded, Union Leagues were founded in 1861 in Pekin, Illinois, and they funded the Civil War for the North. The Union didn't have enough money to pay for the war, so businessmen got together, formed like the 22nd Illinois Regiment, paid for by a group of businessmen. The person who put in the most money became the brigade leader until he was killed, and then it kind of moved up the progression. So Union League in New York and Union League in Philly still go back to those roots. They were founded in the 1860s, and on the walls in those clubs are the names of their members who died in multiple wars, including the Civil War. Fascinating history. Yeah. So they're really pure in what they do and what they are. Interesting that Union League Club in New York is not prospering nearly as Union League Club in Philadelphia is. But again, within a couple of blocks of the Union League in Philadelphia, in New York, you've got scads of wonderful clubs.
Yeah. And I think people love to connect with stories like that. People just love a narrative that they can feel a part of something. I think that's so important. Very well said, John. Speaking of stories, and because you go way back, I know you told me a story the other day about Barry Goldwater visiting one of your clubs. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this question. What happened when Barry, Mr. Goldwater, the senator, visited your club?
Okay, well, Senator Goldwater was a member at Phoenix Country Club. And so I cut my teeth in the club world in the Army running the Officers Club at Leavenworth, Kansas, which had 27 holes of golf. And then I came out of the military, went to Playboy for 3.5 years, and then went to Phoenix Country Club as the assistant GM. And those were the days when we were doing the Phoenix Open. And on Wednesday of the Phoenix Open is the Pro-Am day, as we all know, who've been involved in golf tournaments. And on the first tee every year was Senator Goldwater, who was a senior senator and longtime member at Phoenix Country Club. His brother, Bob Goldwater, at the time was running the Thunderbirds, which were the not-for-profit group that put on the Phoenix Open. So on the first tee, I had Barry Goldwater, Arnold Palmer, Bob Hope, and along with him was a guy named Gardner, who was the chairman of the board of Armadale Greyhound, which had just moved to Phoenix. Mm-hmm. Just as Senator Goldwater is about to tee up his ball and there's the crowd lining the first fairway, immigration pulled a raid and all of the dishwashers, greenskeepers, busboys go running through the crowd, across the first fairway in right in front of Senator Goldwater. And Senator Goldwater was not known for controlling his temper or thinking that there was any value in that. And he went absolutely berserk. So everything settles down. They tee off. About 2 hours later, I get called into the clubhouse. And on the phone is a guy. His first name was Jack. And I think I'll just not use his last name. He was the head of Immigration and Naturalization, as it was called in those days, for mm-hmm. Phoenix. And he said, Mr. McCabe, Senator Goldwater's office has called me and told me that I need to come and talk to you. May I please come and talk to you? And sensing the urgency in his voice and knowing the senator well, we met. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating that actually we worked out a deal where we would run the social security numbers of potential hires through INS before we hired them. And that became the forerunner for E-Verify, which came about, you know, years later. But That was the pilot program that they started based on Senator Goldwater playing in the Phoenix Open.
I love that story.
77 or 78. Can't tell you which year it was, but something in there.
I love it.
Strange how the world happens, huh?
Yeah, that might not be one of the histories that the clubs want to tell, but I got a kick out of that story. But when you're building your brand, I do think that telling a great narrative is so important. What are some other aspects of the club of the future? Where do you see things going? And what types of things should clubs be doing to get ready to get the next level and next generation of member out there?
I would urge your audience to grab their computers and go look at a couple of clubs. London was really where our club culture came from. And once again, our English brethren are way ahead of us in what they're doing. There are a couple of places that I want them to really look at. The newest is called the Hay Hill Club, H-A-Y, second word Hill, H-I-L-L, Club. Just opened 6 months ago. Advertises in the first class section of British Airways, and their kind of tagline is they're a co-working space, but they have a Michelin-starred chef. It's not your regular co-working space where you get, you know, there's a Starbucks down the street and you can bring your brown bag. For £150 a month, you get the opportunity to come to the club and sit at any table that there's space, and that is your working space for the day. And their kind of tagline is, isn't it great to have a space where you can hot desk in the morning and chug on a cigar at night? And I was speaking to 250 Canadian club managers, and I said, I can think of nothing more dreadful than having to fight for a place at a desk that's not even mine, pay £150 or, you know, almost $200 a month for it, and then stay at the same place and eat and drink later in the evening and socialize. Mm-hmm. And at that event, there are 250 Canadian club managers, interestingly enough, at the Union League Club in Chicago. And there's a table of 10 right smack dab in front of me, and it's all their interns. So I've got these 22 to 25-year-old really sharp young people sitting there, and they're looking at me and giving me a dirty look. And I go, okay, time out. What's going on here? And I said, do you guys and gals think that that's cool to work and socialize and sitting at a desk and you don't know where you're going to be every day is okay? And they go, yeah, we think that's great. Mm-hmm. And I went back to a slide that I had just shown that showed one of the other clubs, and the decor was wild and crazy with stripes and checks. And I just thought it was grotesque. And I said, what do you think of this picture of the decor of the club? And they said, oh, we think it's fabulous. Mm-hmm. And I said, hello, Canadian club managers, pay attention here.
Right.
These are really conservative young people because they're working for you and they're way ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my epiphany about how real these clubs are, how important they are. And in London, they are not supplanting the traditional clubs, but they're complementing them. Mm-hmm. And they're killing it in terms of getting members.
Sure.
They're killing it with the membership. And this the traditional clubs are struggling.
How do you get a traditional club to then go in that direction, though, when you've got a board pulling them in the opposite direction most times?
If you have the luxury of space, you can actually carve out some space and build your first kind of co-working space together. You've got to be flexible on dress code, and you've got to it's really funny. Clubs establish rules that once upon a time maybe had a purpose, but over the years they've lost their purpose. And then members get vested in the rules. And so you end up enforcing a rule because how dare you break my rule rather than the rule is meaningful. Mm-hmm. Washington Athletic Club has a great dress code. The dress code is you may not dress in a way that would offend another member. Mm-hmm. That's your dress code.
Yeah.
It's an athletic club. Mm-hmm. So, and the members police themselves and they don't have a problem. And they don't have this thing that says, oh, you have to wear slacks or you can't wear jeans. You can't do this. You can't do that. And the members, the edge is taken off of it.
Right.
You don't have this 72-year-old guy sitting there going, that young person's coming in jeans. Well, it's okay.
Sure.
That's what matters. So it requires a mindset. It requires changing the rules. Young people don't like rules. Actually, you know, I grew up with, you know, there was that old sign that sign everywhere, sign. Mm-hmm. And one of the lines was, I put my hair up under my hat and then I went inside. And one of the places was a private club. And the guy said, I wouldn't be a member of your club. Mm-hmm. Well, in London, there's a club called the Groucho Club, and it got its name because Groucho Marx said I'd never be a member of any club that would have me as a member. So they're one of the, okay, so I gave you, Hay Hill Club is one that people should look at. Groucho Club is the number one that people should look at. In fact, a really good friend of mine named Mark Anderson, who used to run the Lansdowne Club in London, the St. James Club in London, is now in Sydney, Australia, running the big club there, is a member of Groucho. As well as the hospital club. Paul Allen of Microsoft is one of the principals in that club. And when you go to their webpage, there's a 2-minute introduction by his partner that talks about what the club is. And it's a place where collisions can happen.
I like that. You never know what you're going to bump into.
Well, and that's what it, so when you think about a place like the Cosmos Club, it's designed where intellectuals can come together and collide with each other and be with each other, meet with each other, and Union League Club is a place where people who are interested in doing good in the community can come together and meet and do things. University clubs are people who are intellectual can come together. So there, in the Soho houses, the people who are in the arts and advertising and PR and that sort of stuff can all come together. So there's that real cohesive spirit that exists in those clubs.
I think the point you're making is that clubs need to be known for something rather than trying to appeal to everybody. And I think that's been the problem. And I think you've really hit the nail on the head there, where you can't be everything to everybody. And so you should really stop trying. In fact, you should get really, really highly targeted on who that perfect member for you is. I think I'm totally on board with that, John.
Yeah. It's so interesting. When clubs do strategic planning, they usually use the board of directors. And so often, that's really not the right group of people to be doing the strategic planning. And right. No offense, boards of directors. But you need to have boards of directors that truly represent the club. And you need to have boards of directors that recognize what the next generation wants and what it takes to get them in.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. How do you steer that ship as a manager?
Great question. The answer is it depends a lot on your board. Mm-hmm. Clubs do really, really, really well, in my opinion, when they have a very strong manager and a very strong board that have the good of the club at heart. Mm-hmm. If there's a weak manager and a strong board, there's a chance for success. If there's a weak man, if it's the other way around, there's a chance for success. But if you have a wishy-washy board and a wishy-washy manager, you're doomed to disaster. Mm-hmm. When I first came to the Union League Club 25 years ago now, there was a really strong board of directors, and I was brought in specifically as a catalyst of change. And I had proven that that's what I do. I make change. Mm-hmm. And I still make change. And I may be an old guy now and a senior statesman, but I think my thinking in terms of what clubs should be is very different than what most managers who are actually working in the business is. Mm-hmm. So we had Rick Coyne likes to quote this article because he saw it, but I'd been at the club like 3 months, and Cranes had a picture of me on the masthead, and it came out Sunday night in those days, and my family was still in Phoenix, and my front office manager called me and said, I was living at the club, and called me, and I came down, and the headline was, "It's not your dad's Union League club anymore," says general manager John McCabe. I called my wife and I said, "I may be home tomorrow." but the board loved it. That's exactly what they wanted. Mm-hmm. So you can't always get what you want, but you've got to get what you need. Mm-hmm. And Mick is one of my favorite guys. It takes a really smart manager to figure out how to lead the board to the promised land. And I'm happy to help in any way that I can, phone calls or whatever. Yep. But it's an art, not a science, on how to lead a board to the promised land and how to get the right people. If your board isn't made up of the right people, how to get them to bring some of those people into the conversation and help generate the focus.
Yeah, you got to be a politician to some degree, it sounds like.
Yeah, a big degree.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap things up, I think it's so unique that you managed one of these Playboy clubs, and it was one in Chicago, I believe. So I'd just love to give folks a little taste of what that was like. Was that back in the 70s, John?
It was. I came out of the Army in 1974. Our daughter had been born at Fort Leavenworth, something she's never forgiven me for. But I was on orders to Vietnam as a second lieutenant, and 5 weeks into a 9-week school, Nixon came on TV and nobody went to Vietnam after that. So I ended up running an officer's club rather than running troops in Vietnam. Strange how the world works.
Yeah, right.
Came out of the military, interviewed with Playboy, ended up running the club in Phoenix. So I'm married to the same woman today that I was then, who frankly was prettier than any of the girls. So
you weren't tempted, it sounds like.
Anytime you put a 26-year-old man in a room with 20 really pretty girls, if you're not interested, then there's something wrong. I mean, they're pretty people. and they were by and large, really swell, nice ladies. Mm-hmm. We had great entertainment. So whatever you're going to conjure up in your mind about frivolity and nonsense will be much better than what occurred. It was a nightclub. It was, I had to be in the office at 9 a.m. We were in Phoenix to get the calls from Chicago. Mm-hmm. Christy Hefner just started with the company. When I was there, her grandparents lived in Phoenix. So I saw Hef and I saw Christy an awful lot. It was a wonderful job. I had great entertainment. The comedians that were working, you know, they would come up. Johnny Carson would go on the Playboy circuit. So we had Pat Morita, who became the Karate Kid, you know, Mr. Yep. Miyagi.
Yep.
We had Pat Paulson when he was running for president. We had all the great comics of that era. I had Earl Father Hines, Les McCann, Charlie Bird, Dr. Billy Taylor, you name all the jazz greats. So we had wonderful shows. We had a band in the other room. And it's interesting, Arnie Morton was the guy who interviewed me at Playboy. And I turned down the first job they offered me, the assistant in LA, but Arnie left Playboy and then started Morton's Restaurants.
Wow.
And so Arnie and Hef and a guy named Vic Lowndes were the original founders of Playboy. And Arnie obviously had enormous success. His son and Victor Lowndes' son started a hamburger chain in London called Wimpy's, sold that, and then they started another little hamburger chain called Hard Rock, which they still
little,
own.
Little one out there, yeah, right.
And they still own that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And then Morton's other kids are involved in the restaurant business in huge levels as well. So there have been some great people who came out of the Playboy, operation.
What was one thing from that experience that you were able to take and make use of in other jobs that you had later in your career?
Oh, wow. There's so many. I mean, not the least of which is security.
Yeah. And that's even more important nowadays. There's a lot of things happening with security. That's a hot topic.
Yeah. You know, Playboy, because of what it was, would also draw people who were on the edge of the world. And we in Arizona, you were allowed to carry weapons. Mm-hmm. And we had one guy who strolled in there with a sidearm on one mid-afternoon and was really not behaving in a manner that made anybody comfortable.
Yeah.
So we checked his firearm. I checked his firearm. And the elevators opened right. We were on the 8th floor, which was a high building in Phoenix at the time. We were on the 8th floor, and the elevators opened right to the lobby, and the door bunny sat behind a desk selling, Playboy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when he left after a couple of drinks, still exhibiting really weird behavior, I decided that I would take the elevator down and give him his weapon on the first floor. And then I had the bunny leave the desk because he was talking crazy stuff.
Yeah.
I had the bunny leave the desk and I sat at the desk for the next 2 hours until I was pretty sure that he had gone.
Mm-hmm.
We had a guy who crushed one of the big wine glasses in his hand because the cosmic muffin told him to.
Oh my goodness.
So, it was the 70s.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Yeah. Awesome. So security was a part of it. And also one of the other messages that was really important is never believe your own PR,
mm-hmm.
which is an important lesson for me in terms of humility and one that I tried to talk the bunnies into. And I said, never believe your own PR. And so that became great. And also the power of dudes. Playboy was only charging $25 a year in dues, but they had 10,000 members in Phoenix.
Wow.
And what you got for your $25 a year was the right to come into the Playboy Club, and you got a free magazine each month. Mm-hmm. Magazine was a buck and a half. Yeah. Retail.
Right. So you're 12 and a half bucks in dues, basically.
Yeah. Well, a lot more than that, because the magazines, you know, were basically, you know, that was retail. The cost on it was 10 or 12 cents.
Right.
And so if you look at the power of the dues, all the club had to do was break even, and Hefner made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So that was the other message that, you know, Club Corporation of America really understood well, was the power of the dues line. Dues will make you free.
Right. Yep. Yep.
Those are two good lessons.
Well said. Well said. John, I really enjoyed having you on today, and I hope we can get you back on here for another episode. If folks do want to reach out to you and pick your brain a little bit more, how do they do that?
J McCabe Consulting, the letter J, McCabe Consulting at gmail.com would probably be the most efficient.
Awesome, John. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Gabe, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's a real privilege.
I don't know about you, but I could listen to John McCabe for hours. I love his voice. He's just got a great tone to his voice, but really the content is just so good from John. So I want to thank him for coming on the show. I want to thank you for listening to this show, another week in the books, and I hope you'll come back here next week and join us on another edition of Private Club Radio. Until then, here's to your membership success.
Private Club Radio is brought to you by the Private Club Agency, the premier marketing and consulting firm dedicated to helping clubs increase and retain their membership. Visit privateclubagency.com to learn more.